Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who was Wyatt Earp? Was he the brave hero of Tombstone's OK Corral, the selfless lawman willing to disregard his own safety to pursue the West's most dangerous criminals? Was he at heart an outlaw himself, a horse thief and inveterate gambler with a hot temper and hair trigger? And is it possible he could have been all of those things and a brilliant spinner of his own legend besides? Temple University historian Andrew C. Eisenberg is here to help us get to the bottom of those questions. He's been studying the man and the myth for years and has just published a new book called Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life. Drew, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's a real privilege for me to be here.
Is Wyatt Earp an important figure in the history of the American West because of the facts of his life or because of the fact of his legend?
The legend. I think he's an important figure because of the legend. He was largely under the radar by the end of the 19th century, but he came back in a big way in the early 20th century. He started hanging out at Hollywood studios, and he came back as an icon.
And he invented the life that he might have wished to have led.
That's what I say, yeah. This is really the what is new in terms of the biography that's just published. At the end of the 19th century, to the extent that he was known at all, he was known as a gambler. He was known for having been associated with a heavyweight prize fight, the outcome of which was probably fixed in 1896. And he had a lot of negative celebrity and negative press. And he set about in the early 20th century to remake his reputation. And he went to Hollywood. He befriended a lot of early silent film Western stars. And he regaled them with stories of his past, stories that he had kind of edited to make them more appealing to them. And that's the version that we remember.
You know, he was clearly successful, not only because, of course, we remember him at all, but to the extent that people know a little about Wyatt Earp, lots of people know about Tombstone. They know something about his time farther west. They don't necessarily remember this allegedly fixed prize fight.
No, and there are good reasons for that. Usually when I start talking to people about Wyatt Earp, when I'm giving a presentation or a book reading or something like that, I'll ask them, how did you first come to know about Wyatt Earp? And the answers, you know, usually depend on the age. Younger people will say, well, I saw Tombstone, or I saw the Kevin Costner film, Wyatt Earp. And people who are a little older will say, Burt Lancaster, mm-hmm. Gunfight at the OK Corral. But almost everyone has come to know him through film or television. And those film or television versions have not really been interested, for the most part, in making him a very complex character. They've usually presented him as stoical, taciturn lawman who, while he may have made a few errors, in the end he was on the side of right. And this is really the way Earp wanted to be remembered.
Well, I guess we'd all like to be remembered
that way.
Yeah,
I suppose so.
What was it like, Drew, to grow up in the Earp family?
Oh, the Earps. His father had been born in North Carolina, and just a couple years before Wyatt was born, the entire extended Earp family picked up and moved to northern Illinois, and they essentially sold the big family farm, and they moved into a city, and they kind of shifted into wage labor. So Earp was born right at this moment, and this shift in 19th century American society from a kind of rural to an urban life. But his father wasn't really satisfied. His father was very restless. He picked up and moved the family several times during Earp's childhood, so Earp never had much of what you would call a stable, sort of enduring home. And his father was a kind of, he told a lot of tall tales about his own life. He claimed that he had fought in an Indian war when he had not. He claimed that he had scouted for Daniel Boone, which is a preposterous idea.
He did.
His father also tried his hand at bootlegging for a while. Mm-hmm. He was going to sell liquor in a town that had banned the sale of alcohol. He ran for public office. I think it was difficult to grow up in this very kind of inconstant family life, especially with a father who seems to me, from the historical record, to have been kind of a blustery figure.
Did Wyatt Earp have much formal education?
He had what would have been a standard formal education for people at the time. I mean, he went to school a little bit as a younger man, but for the most part, boys who were raised on a farm, and he did spend some of his time as a young man on a family farm. There were a series of little farm holdings that his father had. That was your practical education.
Mm-hmm.
You were probably going to grow up to be a farmer yourself, or if not, you were going to have to figure it out on your own. So that really does characterize a lot of the way Wyatt Earp lived his adult life. He had to figure things out on his own. This is a world that was shifting away from this very kind of predictable, rural kind of existence into one that was much more commercialized, much more urban, where, unlike people of his father's generation, somebody of Wyatt Earp's generation was going to bump into strangers all the time, which is, a very different way of living your life.
Yeah, and some of those strangers would have a greater sense of belonging, would sort of know the territory, would have the money and the influence to get by more easily than someone like Wyatt Earp.
Wyatt Earp was not, I don't want to present him as a kind of rube. I think he was a very smart person, and he was a very complex person, and he did his best without, what we would now call a kind of formal education,
right,
to figure out and find a path in a world where he did his best, I guess is the way to put it.
So he was eager to get away from a young age to sort of, maybe he shared that wanderlust with his father, longed to even join his older brothers off fighting the Civil War.
Yes. One of the earliest stories about Wyatt Earp is that as a 14-year-old, he tried to run away from his father's household and join the Union Army. Two of his older brothers and a half-brother, who was older, had all joined, had all volunteered to serve. And that's probably true. I mean, he was not, he did not make it in. His father intercepted him and brought him back. But he clearly did not want to live this kind of rural life. He was drawn toward an urban world. But one of the things that I think is interesting about him is that he was part of this generation of men who were slightly too young to have served in the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And the Civil War kind of changed the way American men thought of masculinity. That in the years after the Civil War, there was a much more martial sense to being a man. That men who had the opportunity in the war to prove their courage, well, that became the thing. And so people like Wyatt Earp, who were just slightly too young to assert, he was 17 when the war ended, I think he spent, like a lot of men of his generation, a lot of his adulthood looking up to slightly older men, and particularly his older brothers, who had served, who had the opportunity to prove himself. And it wouldn't be too hard to imagine that Wyatt Earp looked for opportunities to prove himself as an adult as well.
He married young, although I suppose for the time it was not that unusual to marry at that age, but then was a widower within a year.
Yes. In one of his family's many moves, they'd moved from Illinois to Iowa to California and back to Missouri. And Wyatt Earp was with his father in Missouri. He was in his early 20s, and he married another woman, a woman who was in her early 20s as well. And she died within a year. And then he picks up and moves again. And, he never really stopped moving. He spent most of his life, spending maybe a year or two in any one town.
I mean, do you think that his first wife's death truly unmoored him, or did it just sort of hasten the process by which he became who he was?
Well, circumstantial evidence would say that he was, at least in the immediate aftermath of her death, unmoored, because within months of her death, he is south, maybe about 100 miles south of this town in Missouri, arrested for horse theft. He's in what's now the state of Oklahoma, was then Indian Territory. And he's conveyed to a jail just across the border in Arkansas. He's going to stand trial. If he's found guilty, that probably means 5 years in a federal penitentiary. And he manages to avoid all this because he and some other inmates in that jail cell claw their way out and escape. But yes, circumstantial evidence would seem to indicate that he did some impulsive things in the months after she died.
How did that crime not follow him? Because it seems like now, if you were an escaped convict, you would not become, the marshal somewhere.
Well, again, you have to put yourself into the 19th century when you know, this still largely rural world, lots of small towns that, Wyatt Earp is living in. There's a sort of famous historian from the 20th century, a man named Robert Wiebe, who described this world as one of island communities. And this is the kind of world that, Wyatt Earp lived in. And so he could be arrested and charged with horse theft in Arkansas, as he was. But he managed to escape, and he picks up, and he moves a few hundred miles away. And he walks into a new town, and he's a stranger, and people don't know who he is, and he presents himself a certain way. And there, he's able to get away from that kind of record. And he does this several times during his life. He's arrested a few years later in Peoria, Illinois, for consorting with prostitutes. And he eventually picks up, moves from there to Kansas. He's thrown out of Wichita, Kansas, and declared a vagrant in 1876. And he picks up and moves down the road to Dodge City. So this is something that Wyatt Earp learns how to do in this nation of island communities.
And I guess maybe he wasn't alone in that. Lots of people moved hoping to start their lives over.
Yeah. No, this is not unusual in any kind of way at all. I think that not everyone was running away from a criminal record each time. And I think he did that each time he moved to a new town either. But he did fall into a pattern of getting into trouble, sometimes because of a certain impulsivity, which I think characterizes him, and then having gotten into trouble in a certain town, picking up, moving, fleeing, if you will, to another place, and then reinventing himself in that new place as someone else. And he sometimes learned lessons from these problems that he ran into, and sometimes not. Sometimes he got right back into the same kind of problem again.
So you mentioned that he got in trouble for consorting with prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
He enjoyed the services of prostitutes. He worked in brothels. Do we know if for sure whether he was just sort of keeping security or whether he was, in fact, a pimp?
It's likeliest that he was a kind of enforcer at the brothels because he was about 6 feet tall. He was, by all accounts, very strong, muscular, kind of intimidating. And this would have been the likeliest kind of employment for him.
Mm-hmm.
He was living at one of the brothels where he was arrested, so he clearly was employed there, I think. It's not that he was a customer each time he was arrested. He was a confederate of the women. Whether he was a pimp, there's no real evidence that he was that. I think it's likelier. I think the best assumption, the best educated guess, is that he was a kind of bouncer at the brothel.
And there were some parts of the country where brothels were tolerated, assuming that they paid their sort of taxes and dues to the municipalities.
Yeah, this is one of the things that Hollywood films sometimes get right, that yes, in cow towns and mining camps in the West, which is, you know, where Wyatt Earp grew from sort of being a teenager into young adulthood, yes, this was tolerated. You would pay a license fee to the municipal government, and gamblers would pay a license fee as well, and then you were allowed to operate more or less openly. One of the things that we have to think about in terms of Wyatt Earp's association with prostitution, and several of his brothers were also involved in being bouncers or sort of perhaps pimps for brothels, is that prostitution becomes much more visible during the 19th century. The Civil War is one reason why prostitution becomes much more visible. But it's also part of a kind of changing sense of people's sexuality during this period, that in rural America, families had a lot of children, families are getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and one of the things that's happening in the middle of the 19th century is that people start to reconceive of sex as not primarily for procreation, but also as an erotic activity, and prostitution is one of the things that kind of happens during the middle of the 19th century, at least becomes much more visible because of this.
Andrew C. Eisenberg is my guest. He's a historian at Temple University and author of the new book, Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life. If you want to join us, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Temple University historian Andrew C. Eisenberg. His new book is called Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Drew, what did you learn about Wyatt Earp's tolerance for alcohol and how that might have affected his drinking habits?
His sister, in her reminiscences, said that when, as a young man, he's accompanying his older brother around in the West, and his brother takes him to a saloon, and he had, you know, his first drink of whiskey, and then just became violently ill. And his brother advised him, you know, take another small drink; this will make it better. He just became even worse. And then, for most of the rest of his life, perhaps until he became much much older, he swore off alcohol entirely. And it could well be that he was one of those people who had one of these rare genetic inabilities to break down the toxicity in alcohol. And so he just had a real susceptibility to drinking it. And that would explain why he was one of the few people in the Western world that he inhabited who just swore off liquor entirely.
Well, it would seem that would serve him well in places where he was charged with, say, keeping law and order, and everybody else around him was drunk.
Well, I think where it served him best was in winning the approval of the kind of genteel middle-class people who would be the cattle dealers or the judges or the lawyers or the merchants who are running places like Wichita and Dodge City and Tombstone. Because if you didn't drink, that was a real cultural marker in the 19th century. It was a sign that you were, you know, someone who adhered to these kinds of middle-class norms of self-control and what they saw as proper behavior. So, you know, for whatever reason that he, you know, tended to not drink, you know, whether it was, as I hypothesize, a kind of genetic inability to process it, or he just didn't like it, or whatever the reason may be, that put him in the good graces of people who ran these towns.
No genetic aversion to gambling.
No, no. He actually made his living for most of his life as a gambler. I mean, I was thinking about this just recently. I was toting up in my mind the amount of time he spent as a lawman. And it was a year in Missouri and a year in Wichita and about half the year for 4 years in Dodge City and maybe a year altogether in Tombstone. So, you know, you add it up. That's the way we remember him. But that was not what he did for most of his life. For most of his life, he made his living dealing a very popular game in the 19th century West called Faro. It's spelled F-A-R-O. And it's modeled on the word, you know, the Egyptian king, Pharaoh. Mm-hmm. And it was a game, I don't want to get too deeply into the details of it, but it's a lot like three-card Monte. That, you know, the odds are actually very even between the dealer and the players. Mm-hmm. And so a man who was able to, or a woman, because there are a lot of women who dealt Pharaoh as well, if they were able to make their living dealing this game, they were almost by definition a cheat. And a lot of the people who played Faro understood that the dealer was trying to cheat them. And they were going to try to outsmart the dealer or out-cheat the dealer, and that was the kind of game that they were all involved in. And Wyatt Earp was, by all accounts, very good at this.
How did he make decisions about where he would move from city to city and silver mine town to silver mine town?
Well, in the 1870s and 1880s, he clearly went to what were at the time the richest, most heavily populated first cow towns and then mining camps. He went from Wichita, then to Dodge City, just as Dodge City was kind of replacing Wichita as the center of the cattle trade. And then following the silver strike in Tombstone, he went down there. He left Tombstone after a couple of years, after all the violence there. And he went immediately to another silver town, Gunnison, Colorado, and from there to another one in Idaho. And so he spent the next several years moving from mining town to mining town and set himself up in each one of those places, not as a lawman, but as a professional faro dealer. Sometimes he was there with one or more of his brothers, and his brothers would be running what they would call a dance hall, which was essentially a brothel. Mm-hmm. So this is the way he made his living for many years after Tombstone.
So, you know, you mentioned that Tombstone, he wasn't there for that long, but he did sort of form his celebrity around his time there. Set it up for us, the sort of town this was. It was a boom town in Arizona. There was silver everywhere. And there was tension between the old timers who had made their money from ranching and all the new people who came in hoping to strike it rich.
I think you've actually described it very well. Wyatt Earp comes there in late 1879. He's one of the earliest people to get there. There had been some ranchers in the area, but there are lots of people, about 10,000 people altogether, who move in to become part of the silver strike. And they're not all, you know, prospecting for silver. That's a kind of romantic notion. There are lots of wage laborers employed in the silver mines, and then there are lots of businesses to serve the silver economy. And Wyatt Earp stays there until spring of 1882, when all the kind of violence that we're all familiar with, I think, from the Hollywood films kind of reaches its head, and he has to leave.
Mm-hmm. And it was not the backwater that we might imagine it was, at least not when Wyatt Earp was living there.
No, not at all. There are about 10,000 people. It had telephone service. It was one of the first places in the Southwest to get telephone service after telephones were invented. I stumbled across this in one of the documents I was reading. It was a memoir that Earp had dictated, and he said, you know, I got on the phone and I called Tucson, and I thought, oh, this is, you know,
come on.
How can this be? Come on. And then I looked more deeply into it, and I thought, oh, that really was.
Wow.
So it's kind of interesting to me that we kind of have this Hollywood notion of a primitive West, but it was, you know, in many ways as technologically advanced as it could be.
Now, the Earp brothers went to Tombstone, and they were going to, like, run a stagecoach, right?
That is what Earp said at different points in his life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not fully convinced of that, because in the same documents where he said he went to, you know, as a stagecoach driver, he also claimed that he came in already wearing a badge, either as a deputy U.S. Marshal or as a deputy county sheriff, and neither of those are true. And there's no real explanation of where the horses or the stagecoach came from. Under oath, he did admit in an early 20th century legal case where he was called to give a deposition that what he did when he first got the Tombstone was to deal faro.
Mm-hmm.
And he clearly was doing that for most of the time he was there.
You think Tombstone stuck with Earp in part because he did lose his brother there?
That they stuck with him, you mean?
The experiences that he sort of chose to make that the seminal event around which to build his legend later on.
Well, he didn't have much choice in that.
Mm-hmm.
That was the event that most people associated with him. He very much wanted to be sheriff of Cochise County, which is, and Tombstone was the county seat for Cochise County. Because being sheriff was an extremely lucrative position. You were able to keep a portion of the tax monies you collected. And the largest taxpayer, almost the single taxpayer in the county, was the Southern Pacific Railroad. So it was a really easy job. You could make maybe $30,000 a year.
Wow.
Extraordinary sum of money in that period. And he was scheming to get himself elected to this. And he thought the way to do it was to catch some stage robbers. Who had recently robbed a stage as it was leaving Tombstone. And he conspired with some local cowboys that those cowboys would lure these guys to their ranch where Earp would arrest them, and then these guys he'd conspired with would keep the reward money. This all started to fall apart, and then those cowboys who'd conspired with Earp felt that he was going to reveal their complicity, and that's what led to the shootout. And once that shootout happened, cowboys then took their vengeance on a couple of the Earp brothers. Wyatt's older brother, Virgil, was shotgunned one night and lost the use of one of his arms, and his younger brother, Morgan, was murdered while he was shooting pool. And after that, Wyatt Earp, in the weeks following that, just got some of his friends together. He had a badge as a deputy United States Marshal at that point, but he just went out and essentially summarily executed a few people he thought were associated with the killing of his brother Morgan.
And then, as now, that sort of behavior was not legal.
He was indicted for murder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether he would have been convicted of that, I don't know. He was acting under the color of the law. But if you look at the autopsy reports, at least the first two people who were killed, they were shot multiple times and did not fire their own weapons. So it looks like an execution. A lot of that was forgotten. You know, Earp went away, kind of drifted back into anonymity. But then he made a kind of miscalculation in 1896 when he reemerged and found himself as a referee in this heavyweight prize fight in San Francisco, and the outcome to almost all observers at the time looked like it was fixed, and that Earp, as the referee, was deeply implicated in the fixed outcome of the fight. And it was then that people just started asking, who is this guy Wyatt Earp? Hmm. And all the old stories about Tombstone and about his vigilantism were dredged back up. Both people who thought well of him, but he had a lot of detractors as well. And so stories, some true, some false, started popping up again. And that's when Earp became very concerned about this negative celebrity that he had somehow acquired and started to try to... He resented it for many years. And only after a few years did he figure, you know what, I will use this new national media culture to try to remake my own reputation. I'm not living in a nation of island communities anymore where I can simply pick up and go somewhere and no one will have heard of me. Everyone has heard of me. Hmm. But perhaps I can use Hollywood to have them hear of me the way I want them to.
We haven't talked at all here yet about Doc Holliday. And everybody is always curious, I think, about that relationship. I guess Wyatt maintained, although never elaborated on Doc having saved his life.
That was a story that he told, that Doc Holliday saved his life in Dodge City when Wyatt Earp was an assistant marshal there, an assistant police officer there. That could be.
Mm-hmm.
Wyatt Earp told a lot of stories. Some of them are clearly not true. Some of them we just have to take his word for it. It could be true.
Do you think that was, it's a ridiculous question almost in 2013, but was that a healthy relationship?
Let's talk about Doc Holliday, who was a very complex figure. He was from Georgia. He contracted tuberculosis. This was, a fatal disease. Everyone figured in the 1860s and 1870s. He goes to the Southwest because that drier climate is supposed to be better for him. He, at the time he goes out to Dallas, that's actually his first stop.
Mm-hmm.
He's a member of a Methodist church and he joins a temperance society, but with his health failing, he starts giving up all of those middle-class mores, and he is drinking and gambling, and as he's gambling, he's getting involved in fights, and there are a couple shootouts that he's involved in already in Texas before he picks up and moves. Like Wyatt Earp, he's following the kind of gambling circuit around and dealing these games.
Incredibly smart as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think like Wyatt Earp, he was quite bright. He was quite bright. There's no question about that. They were very good friends. I think that's clear. And I think that what we need to understand is that they lived in a time when it was very difficult to socialize unchaperoned with someone of the opposite sex. And so both men and women in the 19th century found their closest friendships with someone of the same gender. And so for Wyatt Earp, who's, his family is involved in prostitution, I think, he had prostitutes if sex is what he was interested in. But I think he reserved his closest emotional bonds for, someone like Doc Holliday.
Mm-hmm.
Friendship was something he found with men. If I'm making that clear, but
yeah.
You asked, was it a healthy relationship? I don't think it was unhealthy. I think Doc Holliday was a very cantankerous and by a lot of accounts a difficult person, and like Wyatt, sort of impulsively violent sometimes.
Yeah, I guess my question was that, the influence that they had upon each other.
Yeah, I think they had a healthy relationship, if you want to ask it that way.
How violent was the Old West? I mean, are visions accurate?
How violent was the Old West? It's a great question to which there probably is no real answer. The problem is, if you want to look at murder rates in these places, there are so few people in these cow towns and mining camps that one year there might be three murders in the town, and it's like 20 times more violent than New York City at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And the next year, there will be no murders, which makes it the safest town in America.
Right.
So the statistical sample is so small that it's really hard to figure.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that most of the deaths that are happening are, you have a lot of young men, cowboys or miners, in these towns. They're bored. They have firearms. There's access to alcohol. There's sort of thwarted affection or drunken brawls. It's that kind of crime. It's rarely the kind of stagecoach robbery shooting, although that, you know, obviously does happen as well. And in fact, even rarer than that is the kind of tombstone shootout that Wyatt Earp is involved in, with the vigilante killings after that. It's usually more tragicomic than not.
So Wyatt Earp stayed longer with his final wife than any of the others. Was she the great love of his life?
That's a good question. He did stay with her for a very long time. Although there's another book by a woman who's written just about her, and she says that Wyatt was not particularly faithful during all those years,
mm-hmm.
and that's an interpretation that resonates with the way I've come to understand him. He was restless,
mm-hmm.
and on the move a lot. That's really hard to answer.
Mm-hmm.
That's really hard to answer. It's hard for me to say. He's, you know, people didn't necessarily talk about there's no surviving documents about Wyatt Earp and his emotional life to any great extent. We have to kind of tease out what meaning we can from the few things that are left.
My guest is Andrew C. Eisenberg. He is a historian at Temple University and author of the new book, Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372. You can also join us by sending email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in about 3 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with historian Andrew C. Eisenberg. He teaches and does research at Temple University. His new book is called Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Drew, Wyatt Earp is living in California. He's given a gift by his, I guess, brother-in-law of a book.
Yes. In the first years of the 20th century, he is given a copy of Owen Wister's very popular novel, The Virginian, which is a novel about the West. It's about a man who is a cowboy and rises up to be a kind of leader in the town. There are two important violent events toward the end of the novel. One of them is a shootout. In which there's been some public insults, and you know, the Virginian has to gun down the bad guy, and all the townspeople crowd around and congratulate him. And the other one is an act of a vigilante hanging, that one of the Virginian's old friends has been caught stealing cattle, and as the Virginian puts it in the novel, a man goes through with his responsibilities, and he imposes this death penalty because he has to.
Mm-hmm.
And when Wyatt Earp read this novel, which was incredibly popular in the first years of the 20th century, went through a lot of printings, it was made into a stage drama, what he found there was the explanation for his vigilantism that had long eluded him. Hmm. He'd struggled for years to try to figure out how to publicly justify his resort to vigilante violence. And most people up until that point thought that he just exacted his vengeance. But now he had a new way of explaining it. I had to do this. This was the way you really enforced justice in the Old West. So he modeled his interpretation on Owen Wister's, and he took that interpretation to Hollywood, and he starts talking to people in Hollywood, to William S. Hart and Tom Mix. He meets Charlie Chaplin. He charms Charlie Chaplin, the director Raoul Walsh, Alan Dwan, and they encourage him to put his story into the form of a memoir, and then they can use that memoir as the basis of a film. And that's what he really spends the last 15 years of his life doing, is dictating his memoir over and over again, trying to get the right story down on print, on paper.
And I suppose it's always been the case that in Hollywood, what matters most is a great story that you can sell, and, you know, the facts may be exactly correct or not, and that's not such a concern.
I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, it all kind of fits together in a sort of way. If you think about the Hollywood image of Earp, I mean, he's sort of modeling his story on the Virginian. He's also thinking of an actor in mind as he's telling the story. The person he wants to play him is William S. Hart, who is probably in the 19-teens the most popular Western film star. And he plays these stoical, taciturn guys who may have done some things that were not so savory, but in the end of these two real films, he always is on the side of justice. And this is the way Earp wanted to be remembered, and this is the way he managed to get himself remembered.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to George in Dallas. Hi, George.
Hi. My question is this. Hollywood gave us the Gary Cooper High Noon, stand 50 feet in the apart in the street, quick draw, shoot each other. And then Clint Eastwood gave us the Unforgiven that said, you know, the truly dangerous man in the Old West was the one who, at close range in a hail of bullets, would, you know, calmly take aim at you and fire. Which one's more true, and where did Wyatt fall in that spectrum? I'll hang up, take the answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
I'm not sure whether I'm qualified to say which one is more true. I can tell you that Wyatt Earp's actual involvement in violent gunplay was much more limited than Hollywood has told us. When he was in Dodge City as a police officer, he was one of a couple people who fired at a cowboy who was riding out of town, and he may have been the person who shot him, and that cowboy died a month later of his wounds. He may have been the person who shot another guy as part of a posse in Dodge City when they rounded that guy up. The OK Corral gunfight, which is a misnomer because it didn't happen in the OK Corral, was 30 seconds long. And Wyatt Earp fired off one shot in the beginning, maybe two, and then one of the cowboys came up and started grappling with him, and Wyatt's effective participation in the gunfight was over at that point. And then in his vigilante rides, as I said, you know, he was one of several men all armed, and the people who were shot didn't manage to get a shot off. So he's not the kind of lone gunman standing alone in the street. In almost all of these instances, he's got a group of people with him. It's just not the Hollywood scenario when you look at what really went on with Wyatt Earp.
Did he ever take any of the stories of Virgil's law enforcement career and sort of make himself the star in those?
He did that a couple times. When he told stories about how he came to Tombstone already with a commission as a deputy United States Marshal, he did not. His brother, Virgil, did. His brother, Virgil, came to Tombstone with that commission already. And Wyatt eventually received that badge, but not at first. He also, there was a very dramatic event in Tombstone where there was a young man who was going to be lynched, and the town marshal at the time stood down this lynch mob, and this was a man named Ben Sippy, and in telling his story, Wyatt Earp presented that as if he had been the person who had stood down that lynch mob. So when people did things that he admired, he was not beyond appropriating those things for himself.
So can you look, Drew, at any document that sort of is original to Wyatt Earp's life, anything he wrote down? And as a historian, can you use it, or do you have to assume, you know, anything that he wrote might be fabricated in a way that, you know, Ben Franklin's letters you might not have to worry so much about?
I think we assume that about anybody.
Uh-huh.
When you're looking at any kind of primary document, no historian wants to take that at face value. You want to look at the context. You want to try and figure out, do a very close reading of this document and see what's at play here. There are not a lot of documents from Wyatt Earp himself. There are some letters he wrote at the end of his life. There's some court testimony that he gave. But the court testimony that he gave following the Tombstone shootout was a prepared testimony. He didn't submit to questioning, and so it was probably prepared by his lawyer. So even things that are purportedly from Wyatt Earp himself may not be. So it's really difficult trying to figure out what's going on. So what we have of Wyatt Earp is his actions, right? We can put him in certain places, and we can judge him by what he was doing. Writing a biography of him was a challenge because he was not one of those people who just left reams and reams of letters and journals, and you could just kind of pour into it and have a lot of words to play with. Not a lot of that has survived. And someone asked me recently, what would you wish for here? What I really would have wished for would have been some of the correspondence that he must have carried on with his family.
Mm-hmm.
But all of that is gone.
Yeah. What about newspapers at the time? There were exploits of his, things that he did that would make the papers either, hailing him as a hero or sort of deriding his actions. But I have to imagine that, travel was hard. Some of these may have been secondhand accounts. What can you take from those?
I read just about every available newspaper account that I could. And as you said, sometimes he's praised and sometimes he's criticized. There are telegraphs, so news travels actually pretty quickly from different, through from one place to another in the West. So when something happens in Tombstone to Wyatt Earp, people in Dodge City who are still friends of his or know him are hearing about it right away, and they're reporting on it. So, you can place him in these places, but newspapers, if you're reading these as a historian, you have to read them carefully because they're not, you can't simply say, oh, this is what happened then.
Back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Jean on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jean.
Hello. Thanks, Chris, for taking my call. And thank you to your guest for writing this wonderful book. I actually have read another book. It's a fictionalized version called Doc. And in this particular version, she says that regarding Doc Holliday saving Wyatt Earp's life, she says that it would have been impossible for Doc to save Wyatt Earp because he was so sick with tuberculosis. Can you speak to that, or have you had any thoughts around that? And I'll take my response off the air.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, it's a good question. I think he had tuberculosis. He died of tuberculosis in 1887. For the sort of 10 or 12 years before that, when he had the disease, he seemed to carry on a fairly vigorous life. I mean, he was not involved in shootouts all the time. That wouldn't be the way to put it. But he seemed to move around from place to place, and he seemed to get around just fine. So I think it certainly could have been possible. But again, we have Wyatt's testimony for this event and the testimony of a couple other people. And it may have happened. What's most important is that these two guys met each other at some point in the Southern Great Plains in the mid-1870s and became very good friends.
So Wyatt Earp would clearly love knowing that we're talking about him, 80 years after his death.
Well, I'm not sure that he would.
You don't
think? I'm not sure. He certainly would not approve of anyone, least of all me, telling his story. He, dictated his life story several times, starting in around 1918, 1919. But he was very controlling about his life story. He didn't want anyone talking about him other than he himself. He really wanted to be remembered in only the way that he saw fit. And he was very upset when other people who'd been involved in the events in Tombstone started writing about what was happening there and depicting him in ways that he objected to. Or even if they depicted him in ways that he approved of, he objected to that as well. He was extremely controlling about his own past.
Never had any kids?
No.
I guess it wasn't a choice so much back then, but I wonder if he would have, had he had, you know, sort of children to leave a legacy to, if he would have been less invested in giving his story to the world.
You know what? Your guess is as good as mine on that. Hard to say.
What do you think it was about the period in sort of Depression-era America when his story really broke big that made it ready for Wyatt Earp's version of the Wyatt Earp story?
Well, his first biographer, Stuart Lake, Wyatt Earp, Frontier Marshal, Lake's biography comes out in 1931. He kind of presents Wyatt Earp as an Old West Elliot Ness. Mm-hmm. And the cowboys are presented as, you know, not just sort of, you know, small-time cattle rustlers, but as basically a kind of criminal gang like the Chicago Mafia, and the leader of the cowboys is like Al Capone. And it's presented that way. And, I mean, one way to think about the way the vigilantism is described then in that biography is that it's a kind of justification, the same way that the FBI in the 1930s needed sometimes to use extra-legal methods to get at bootleggers and the mafia. Well, so did Wyatt Earp. Just when your enemy is that bad, that's what you have to do. And so it's a kind of justification for that in some ways.
What do you find fascinating about this individual, so much that you would spend years sort of trying to find the truth about his life?
Well, I think like anybody who starts out on a project like this, you learn things as you're going along.
Yeah.
I became very interested in the way that he was able to and so interested in reinventing himself over and over again. I mean, when I started out, I knew that there had been a lot of Hollywood myths about him. I knew that his first biographer, Stuart Lake, had made up a number of things. And I thought that I could strip away these various myths and I could get down to the real story if I could find out, you know, just narrow it down just to what Wyatt did and what he said. And what I found was that Wyatt's reinventions were the real story, that the way he kept telling stories about himself and reinventing himself, that in fact was what characterized his life.
Are you willing to speculate on whether he was happy with his life?
That's an excellent question. I don't really know. I don't really know. I don't think he was particularly reflective, put it that way. Again, I'm not saying he wasn't bright. I'm not saying that he didn't have good qualities. But, you know, he was somebody who was able to just, when bad things happen, just move on and, and forget about it or tell a new story about it. And so I don't, you know, whether that means he was able to maintain a kind of placidity or a sort of even-temperedness about these things, he seemed to have done that. It's hard to say.
Andrew C. Eisenberg is a historian at Temple University and author of the new book, Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life. Drew, it's been so interesting to talk with you. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had production assistance from Lindsay Connect, and our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.